Becknekons. Joseph had long known that forbidding man by sight, had repeatedly seen him on his visits to the House of Women, and sympathized with the anger in Pharaoh's soul at sight of Becknekons's pomp and state. Troops of the god, with spears and clubs, ran before his carrying chair as it swayed on long poles upon the shoulders of 4x4 shiny-pated temple servitors. At its sides were bearers with ostrich-feather fans, and another troop followed behind, as though the god Amun himself were going a progress in his bark. Criers ran in front of the train with slaves, filling the court in advance with their loud, insistent shouts, so that the people hurried up, and he who was set over the house, if not Petipre himself, came to receive the great guest on the threshold. Petipre avoided these occasions, but Montcalm was always on hand, and on sundry of them Joseph had already stood behind him, attentively fixing the great man with his eye. For here was the embodiment, the highest and remotest, of the hostile sun doctrine, as Dudu was its smallest and closest to hand. Becknekons was of goodly stature, and bore himself haughtily, his torso strained upwards from his ribs, his shoulders thrown back, his chin thrust up and out. His head was impressive, egg-shaped, with a never-covered, smooth-shaven poll, and characterized by the sharp and deep-cut furrow between the brows. It was a permanent furrow, losing none of its severity when he smiled, as he sometimes did, condescendingly, or as a reward for some particular obsequiousness. His face, likewise meticulously shaven, was clean-cut and immobile, with high cheekbones and furrows as deeply graven as the one on his forehead about the nose and mouth. He had a way of gazing past men and things, which bespoke not merely arrogance, but a thoroughgoing rejection of the modern world, a denial and condemnation of the whole course of life for centuries or even millennia back. And his raiment, though costly and fine, displayed a priestly conservatism, being fashioned after a mode whole epochs earlier in time. Beneath his outer garment, which began under his shoulders and fell to his feet, could plainly be seen the simple, narrow, brief loin apron, cut in the manner of the first dynasties of the Old Kingdom. To even more remote and thus presumably more pious times belonged the priestly leopard skin, which was draped round his shoulders, with the head and forepaws hanging down his back, the hind paws crossed on his breast, where likewise he wore other insignia of his state, a blue scarf, and a complicated gold ornament with ram's heads. The leopard skin was clearly an unwarranted presumption, for it belonged to the insignia of the head priest of Atum Re at On, and not at all to the servants of Amun. But Becknekons was just the sort of man to decide for himself what was fitting for him, and nobody, not even Joseph, failed to understand why he wore the primitive and sacred skin. It signified that Atum Re had been absorbed in Amun, that he was but a manifestation of the Great One of Thebes, to some extent his subject, and not only to some extent. For Amun, that is to say, Becknekons, had succeeded in making Re's head prophet at On take the honorary title of a second priest of Amun at Thebes. The superior status of the high priest was thus made evident, also his right to the insignia of the other's office. Even at On, Re's own seat, he had managed to prevail, for he not only called himself head priest of all the gods of Thebes, but also assumed the title of head priest of all the gods of Upper and Lower Egypt, and was thus the first of the first in Atum Re's own house. Why should he not wear the leopard skin? Not without awe could one look at this man, in view of all that he represented. And Joseph had come to enough understanding of Egyptian affairs that his heart misgave him as he thought how Pharaoh made him wax evermore in girth and pride by endless gifts of goods and treasures, in the pleasing fancy that it was his father Amun to whom he gave them, and, in a sense, also to himself. Joseph, for whom Amun Re was only an idol, like another, though he kept it to himself, sometimes a ram in his chamber, again a doll-like image in his chapel shrine, whom they took riding in his bark on the Gior, because they knew no better than so to do, Joseph made sharp and clear distinctions which Pharaoh failed to make. He found it not good and not wise of the god to let his supposititious father wax fatter and fatter. They were higher cares which beset him when he saw Amun's greatest disappear into the house of the women, and they transcended, in his statesmanlike musings, his concern for his own welfare, although he knew that it was being threatened by the talk going on inside. He knew from little Bess, his first patron in Potiphar's house, that Dudu had complained of him more than once to Moot, the mistress. The midget, hidden in unlikely places, had been present at these scenes, and made such detailed report to Joseph that the latter could fairly see the keeper of the robes standing in his starched apron skirt before his lady, pompously sticking out his upper lip and gesturing indignantly with his stumpy arms as he sunk his voice to its deepest note and sent up to her ears his plaint over the annoyance and the offense. The slave Osarsif, for so he mysteriously chose to call himself, the Shabirite lout and scum of the desert. Verily, it was a scandal, said Dudu, and a malignant sore the way he waxed in favor in Potiphar's house. Surely the hidden one saw it with displeasure. Not alone that he had been bought, against the dwarf's advice, for far too high a price, 160 deben, of some worthless peddlers from the desert who had stolen him from a prison grave, not alone that he had been taken into the house through the contrivance of the jester Shepsis Bess, the unmarried dwarf, a fellow not worth a rotten nut, but, instead of sending the foreign hand to field labor, as sensible folk had advised the steward, the latter had let him lounge about the court, and he had come to stand before Petipre in the palm orchard, and the rascal had turned it to his advantage in a way that could only be called shameless. And even that was too mild. He had filled the master's ears with the rankest and most insidious jargon, which was an affront to Amun and a blasphemy against the sun. And the exalted master had been taken in, had been criminally bewitched, so that he had made the slave his waiter and servant, while Montcalm treated him like a son, or more correctly, like a son of the house, who was learning to administer it because he was the heir, and plumed himself as the overseer's assistant, a scabby Asiatic in a house of Egypt. He, Dudu, permitted himself most humbly to call the mistress's attention to this abominable state of things, at which the hidden one might be so wroth as to avenge himself for this corrupt free-thinking upon those who committed and suffered it. "What said the mistress?" asked Joseph after hearing. "Tell me exactly, little beauty, repeating, if you can, her very words." "Her words," the little man replied, "were these. While you were speaking, steward of the jewel house," she said, "I have tried to think who he is whom you have in mind, and what foreign slave you accuse in your words. But I have searched my memory in vain. You could not expect me to have all the servants in my eye, and thus understand at once the sense of your words. But in time it came to me that he of whom you speak is the truth, still young in years, who now for a while has filled my husband's cup. Vaguely I can recall the silver apron if I try." "Vaguely?" repeated Joseph with some disappointment. "How can I be so vague to our mistress, when I stand each day beside her and her master at table, and the favor I have found in his eyes and Montcalm's cannot have escaped her? I wonder, therefore, that she must search so long and make such effort before she guessed to whom Dudu's spiteful words referred. What more did she say?" "She said," went on the dwarf, "she said, 'Why do you bring me all this to reproach me, keeper of the wardrobe? For you will call down Amun's wrath upon me. Have you not said he would be enraged at those who suffer the offense to be? But if I know naught, I suffer naught, and you might have spared me and not made me to stand in danger of my knowing.'" Joseph laughed at this and gave it great praise. "What a capital answer! What a shrewd reproof! Tell me more of our mistress, little Bess. Repeat all to me with exactness, for I am sure you listened well." "It was that spiteful Dudu," the dwarf went on, "who said more, justifying himself and saying, 'I have told the mistress not that she may suffer the evil, but may do it away. For out of love for her, I have made occasion that she may serve Amun by telling the master that the unclean slave must be sent away out of the house. Now that he is bought, he should be sent to the fields, instead of making himself master here and setting himself above the children of the land." "Very hateful," Joseph said. "A bad, spiteful speech. But the mistress, what did she say to that?"
"She answered," Little Beauty responded, "and said, 'My solemn friend, it seldom happens that it is vouchsafed to the mistress to speak in confidence with the master. Think of the formal manners of our house, and do not dream that it stands between him and me as between you and her who is your spouse and familiar, Jesset, your wife, who puts her arm about you. She comes in simple confidence and speaks of all her concerns and yours, and may also decide your mind to this or that course, for she is a mother, having borne you two sightly sons, Esesi and Abebi, so that you are bound in gratitude to her, and have all reason to give her your ear and heed her words and wishes. But what am I to the master, and what cause has he to hearken to me? For his self-will is great, his mood unhearing. I am powerless before him with my reminders.'
Joseph was silent, looking thoughtfully over his little friend's head as the dwarf sat with wrinkled, anxious face supported on his hands.
"Well, and the wardrobe master? What answered he?"
Jacob's son probed again after a while. "Did he reply and enlarge himself yet more?" That the dwarf answered in the negative. Dudu had preserved a dignified silence, and the mistress had added that she would speak as soon as might be with the head priest, for as Petipre had advanced the foreign slave after the latter had spoken with him concerning son matters, it was plain that they were here dealing with religion and the state, which were the affair of Beknekens, the great prophet of Amun, and her confessor and friend. He must be told. She would pour into his fatherly heart, to her relieving, all that Dudu had told her concerning the offense. So far, the dwarf's information to Joseph. But the latter recalled afterwards how Bes-Em-Heb lingered, sitting beside him in his comic costume, the cone of ointment perched on his wig, his chin in his hands, somberly blinking. "What are you frowning at, Beauty, in the house of Amun?" he had asked. "Why do you brood over these things?" The other answered in his cricket chirp,
"Oh, my Osarsif, I brood because it is not good that the spiteful gossip speaks of you to Mut, the mistress. How little good it is, and how great harm!"
"Of course not," Joseph replied. "Why do you tell me that, when I know of myself that it is evil and even dangerous? But behold, I have no care, because I trust in God. Has not the mistress herself admitted the weakness of her power over Petipre? It would take more than a word from her to send me to the field, so have no care."
"But how shall I be quiet," whispered Bess, "when there is danger still of another kind, if Dudu open your mistress's eyes and enlighten her concerning you?"
"Who can understand that?" Joseph cried out. "Not I, indeed, for your prattle is like so much gibberish to me. Danger of another kind? What sort of dark saying is it you whisper there?"
I whisper my fear and foreboding," he heard the dwarf say. "I murmur my dwarf-wise cares, of which you, being of the full-grown race, as yet have no notion. The old gossip intends evil, but it may turn out that he has done well, yet only too well, so that in the end it is worse than before, much worse than he thought to make it in his spite."
"Take it not ill, little man, that I understand not one word of your words, for they have no sense. Good? Evil? Only too well? And yet much worse? And that is but little language and dwarfish nonsense, and try as I may, I understand it not."
"Then why has your face turned red, Osarsif? And why are you vexed, as you were before when I said that the mistress knew you but vaguely? My dwarf wisdom would have you remain ever vague to her, for the danger is doubly a danger if the accursed gossip opens her eyes with his malice."
"Ah," the mannikin said, and hid his head in his arms.
"The dwarf is afraid. He is terrified in face of the foe, the bull whose fiery breath scorches the field."
"What field?" Joseph asked.
with willful want of understanding. And what sort of fiery bull? You are not in your right senses today, nor can I give you reason. Go get yourself a soothing drink from Red Belly. It will cool your head. I go to my work. Can I help it if Dudu complain of me to the mistress, however dangerous it may be? But you see my trust in God, and need not be disturbed. Yet take heed always to let no word escape you of that which Dudu speaks before the mistress, and even more what she says to him, and report it to me with exactness, for it is important that I should know.